Hey there, Off the Grid listener. Let's take a moment to dream a little dream together. What if you didn't need to be perfect? You didn't need to start over. You didn't need to be small and quiet so you never caused harm. And you didn't need to do it alone or just try harder. What if instead you could get support at a nervous system level to weather whatever happens in your business? And you could learn trauma-informed best practices for your work that end cycles of freezing, fawning, or people-pleasing. What if you could be held in deep care as you practice honoring your boundaries and amending and accounting for inevitable harm? If any of these dreams are resonating, I want to invite you to join Foundations, a hybrid training container to strengthen your trauma-informed care and business practices, taught by podcast sponsor and somatic trauma-informed practitioner, Jess Jackson. Foundations gathers May 17th through 19th with live trainings and a virtual portal with an actionable curriculum. Learn more and save your spot at the link in the show notes. Welcome to Off the Grid, a podcast for small business owners who want to leave social media without losing all their clients.
Let's go off the grid.
Okay.
Let's go. Off the grid.
Okay.
I know that you really want to put your phone away.
Yeah.
Let's go off the grid.
Hello and welcome to Off the Grid, a podcast about leaving social media without losing all your clients. I'm your host, Amelia Hruby. I am the founder of Softer Sounds Podcast Studio, the co-founder of the Lifestyle Business League. And here on this show, I am your fellow traveler and guide on our journey of doing business with no or minimal social media presence, and hopefully with a lot of radical generosity and energetic sovereignty. If you're new to the show, welcome. You picked a fantastic episode to dive in with. And before I introduce today's guest, I do want to make sure that you know about the free Leaving Social Media Toolkit. This includes the three tools that I use to leave social media. They pair with the first few episodes of the podcast, and you can grab it again for free in the show notes. So if you're new, go get the Leaving Social Media Toolkit. And if you're a longtime listener, welcome back. I truly appreciate your time, your attention, your care, and I think you're going to feel really nourished and expanded by today's conversation. So today on the podcast, I am honored to be joined by Ayana Zaire Cotton. Let me tell you a little bit about their work. Ayana is an anti-disciplinary artist, writer, and facilitator for the World Builders. As the creator of CETA School, they help you create an interdisciplinary practice, release a creative offer, and develop a cohesive narrative through the framework of world building. Welcome, Ayana. Thanks so much for being on Off the Grid.
Oh my goodness. Thank you so much for having me, Amelia. I've been such like a fan of the podcast. Definitely was listening to the podcast as I was trying to give CETA School its wings. So just literally being on the show, it feels really, really special. So thank you.
It feels special to me as well. I want to open by kind of spiraling back together into your journey, because you now teach or guide people through a framework and process of world building. But part of what I love about your story is it really started with your own world building of radical futures and presence. And so could you tell us a little bit about Psykofa, the CETA origin story, and how CETA School came to be?
Mm-hmm. Whenever I tell this story, it has to be a timeline, and my work is so like deeply embedded and is obsessed with non-linearity, right? Like there's nothing linear about this journey, but I think it helps to tell the story in years. So for me, I like to start at 2018, because that is when there was a lot happening in my creative practice. I wanted to add coding to like my interdisciplinary creative toolbox for a variety of reasons. Number one, I was like, okay, this art stuff is cool, it's cute, but where the money at? When am I going to get paid? Everyone was talking about coding just as a way to still be a creative person, but inject like this skill into your life and into your career as a way to get some financial stability and security. But then at the same time, I was also thinking about the election that happened in 2016 and everything that happened with Facebook and data. And I was like, okay, we need community software engineers. We need folks who like are thinking about software with a radical imagination. So I decided to go and take this coding bootcamp. That kind of reminded me that I love learning, which reminded me that I love teaching. So I took a software engineering job, which meant that I ended up overworking and I really kind of got deep into this like spiral of ultimate burnout, overextending myself as a teacher in a variety of ways, abandoned my practice for 2 whole years. And then the pandemic hit. Grief after grief, and then coupled with the stillness, really encouraged me. Like my body, I was like, I need a break. So I took a sabbatical. I left my job in 2020 in September. Terrifying decision, but I knew something had to change. And I was going to take a 3-month sabbatical. And I tried to like get a software engineering job. I tried to do all of the things that you have to do to prepare to get a software engineering job and go down that route. And eventually I was like, oh, wait, no, I actually have to completely become undone. There was just depression and anxiety and just layers of trauma that was starting to surface through this moment of stillness that was really inspired by the pandemic and finally getting a chance to catch my breath after being away from my creative practice for so long. So this is where we kind of start to enter the Psychopha, the story of Psychopha. I ended up in 2021, actually moving back to land that's been in my family for 4 generations. My enslaved ancestors like worked this land for centuries, right? And we're still there. And my 80-year-old aunt generously and graciously rented this small house to me. I shared it with my cousin. And that is when, for like probably the first time in my adult life, I actually let myself cry all day, write all day, right? Like pray all day, wonder all day, really try to sit still with what my desires were. And I was able to, I felt through that move, secure enough to stop that software engineering job search and say, okay, no. What is it that I really need? What is it that I really desire? Like, what is it that is going to not re-enroll me into the loop, right, of fear and like self-abandonment that I had been in? So I started doing ceramics. I started braiding my hair in a certain way. I started writing again. I started making these objects. I started making software just for my creative practice. And I was like, what am I doing all day? Like, what are all of these like different material manifestations of this creative time in my life? What are they? What do they mean? And then in 2021, I also got the Ginkgo Bioworks creative residency where I actually wrote the story. And then that's when I realized, oh, these ceramic artifacts are Psychophian artifacts. Oh, the way I've been braiding my hair is actually the way Psychophians braid their hair. And then I came up with this character, Sita, this non-binary biotechnologist. Now I realize, you know, Sita has truly given form to some of my deepest desires. And, you know, inside the story, there's a bald cypress tree who is our narrator, a 2,600-year-old bald cypress tree who is our narrator. So all that to say, the story really starts with surrender. Deep, deep, terrifying surrender. And ultimately, trusting my creative voice, my creative vision, my creative desire to manifest into a world that I could actually bear, right? So I would say like that's how it all starts. And Cedar School started as a newsletter in 2022 and then later as a school.
Thank you for sharing the story. I'm really struck by the ways that stepping off the path of software you thought it was like a temporary pause and you step back on it. But then actually you're like, oh no, this is like a deep remembrance and we're going somewhere else entirely. I think often when we take on these career paths, we think, oh, this is the one. This is it for me now. And then when they don't work for us, we end up returning not to exactly what we were doing before, but it's like you were making art. You were an artist. You were deep in creative practice before this. Like the software path was the detour, not the like one path you were meant to be on, even though it in those moments where we do need funds, we need some money, we need some assurance, we need some security. It's so tempting to take up those like step by step, really well paved pathways other people have been traveling. But I think for those of us with these like deeply aligned, creative, generative spirits, which I think all of us are that, just covered up with more layers of social conditioning for some of us, we just feel called back into the wilderness and we have to go there. And I really appreciate how your story took you both to new places and to like old places in your life. Again, it's not linear time. we're in like the spiral of the generations with this story and with all of our lives. Another thing I really admire about your work is how it is so beautifully and deeply embedded in Black feminist principles and practices. And listening to your podcast, it's like these thinkers and dreamers and artists are your interlocutors. Like they're your dialogue partners. You're always bringing in like Tony and Audrey and Angela, like all of these people. And I'm like, it's really powerful to hear. And so I'm wondering, could you talk a little bit about like, what does world building mean to you in this lineage? And how are you drawing some of these Black feminist principles and practices into the work that you're doing to build worlds for yourself and with now your students?
Oh my goodness. Where do I start with Black feminism? Right? I'm always invoking both of the Tonys, right? Toni K. Bambara and Toni Morrison. And I love that you highlighted, underlined, circled the piece around dropping into and rooting into ancestral lineage and deep time. Because I really do believe, right, interdisciplinarity is an ancestral remembering the ways in which our ancestors practice and rooted in belonging inside communities, right? And like speaking of ancestry, like I always, I'm also invoking, right, my great-grandmother, Big Mom, my great-grandmother, Honey, both of the Tonys, Toni K. Bambara specifically, reminding us that, you know, our job as cultural workers is to make revolution irresistible. Audre Lorde, Octavia Butler, Catherine McKittrick, Alexis Pauline Gomes, I can't like not see their work as well, Kweke Emezi. And I think a lot of this comes from a practice that I developed and software that I developed in my art practice called Psychopha Narration, where I basically wrote this software to take all of my references and literally seed a database with all of my references and then kind of like algorithmically generate new poems, new stories using this software. So at first, when I was writing the Psychopha Seed of Origin story, I was using that software to write that story. And now I find myself embodying that software when I talk. I'm literally just like weaving. Whenever I talk, I'm like, these aren't my words. These are just a compilation of the references that have literally the wisdom that has literally pulled me through. And I like to even think about that in abstract terms, because some of our references are people with whose names we don't know. Right. But like somehow their memory is showing up in the ways in which we talk and show up and interact in community. Right. And some of those people may be like future ancestors that we're working for and whose memory we're holding, even though maybe they haven't been born yet. So it's there's this operating in like, you know, future time and past time that I think I'm always weaving in my work. I really do believe there's nothing new under the sun. And Black feminism is a political framework that allows me to kind of give form to the worlds that we actually want to see, right? To the worlds that we actually want to build. When we talk about world building, in a lot of ways, the colonial project is a world building project, right? So we have to be very specific about the world that we are building. Yeah. So I always like to anchor it in Black feminism. There's, I got this reference from the Quirk app on Instagram. They posted this like graphic and they were like, Black feminism is not a demographic, it's a politic, right? I love it as a political framework for imagining like the worlds we need and the future we desire, really.
Yeah, I really appreciate you highlighting that world building in and of itself is not necessarily
neutral.
It's not neutral. That's the perfect word. I think that's really important to remember. And like, we have to bring to it these politics, these frameworks, these values so that we're building specific worlds. And so stepping a little deeper into your work at CETA School, why a creative offer? Like, what is supportive about that vessel for world building?
That's an excellent question. And I always start with the fact that in order to build, we need resources. That is just what it is. We need resources in order to build. And that's the first one. The second one is that it's a pathway for divestment, right? So it's a pathway for us figuring out ways in which we can weave the stories of our skills, right? Weave the stories of our detours that you mentioned earlier, right? Which were actually just deepening our interdisciplinary vision, right? And adding to the layers and layers of magic that we already are. How do we weave all of those stories up until this point into a container that like truly, truly serves the people we love and care about? And how might generating income from our creative practice rooted in desire actually create pathways for divestment, create possibilities where we can say Black Lives Matter and our income not be threatened, right? Say Free Palestine until it's backwards and our income not be threatened. Say COVID is still happening and our income not be threatened. There's ways in which it's both a way that actually gives us the resources to world build. It creates pathways for divestment. And lastly, and I think this is what maybe I'm most excited about, is it starts to allow us to experiment with different cooperative economic models. I'm very clear that the goal isn't for us to create a whole bunch of mini businesses and just, you know, replicate the choreographies of neoliberalism, but just on like a fractal scale, right? Like that's not our heart's desire, right? Our heart's desire is to figure out, okay, what's my contribution? What's my contribution? What's my contribution? And how do they interlock in ways that are so powerful that they actually start to actualize the futures that we say we want now, right? Like that, for me, it's about let's practice it now. Let's get creative with it now. And a creative offer is just a really beautiful prompt for imagining and practicing what's possibly beyond capitalism.
Popular marketing advice or business advice is to like niche down and only do the one thing for the one type of person. And I really feel your work kind of refusing that or taking us in a different direction or just like not functioning in those terms. But I think that so much of that, like it leaves us as small business owners are people who want to sell our creative work, feeling like we are limited to being one thing. And what I love about the world building approach and about how you talk about creative offerings is no. If we are one thing, it's only the one thing that is absolutely everything that we have done and are bringing to our work. And I think that that's really powerful in a business, in a creative practice. And I also think sometimes when we hear that, listeners listening might be like, well, that's great, Amelia. And that's like a lot of pressure to figure out everything I've done and integrate it and make it into an offering. And like, I have to birth a whole world right now just to have a business or just to sell something. And I think that, yes, you might get to a point in your practice where a whole new world comes through. And that's beautiful. But also, it can just be sharing differently. It can be the newsletter. Like we can create these vessels in which we're just taking the steps, we're trying the things, we're carving out space in our lives to occupy that world, even if perhaps we still have to go to our day job or we still have to, you know, work for that client that we don't love necessarily, but like we have this space. I mean, that's honestly how I feel about this podcast. It's like, I mean, Softer Sounds at Large, I do feel like I've kind of built a world there, but with Off the Grid, it's like I show up here for my creative fulfillment and to talk to people like you and to make these connections. And it like becomes this space, even within my broader space. And so I think I just wanted to highlight that sort of, I think, generative tension. And I'm curious if you feel it too, between got to integrate it all. That feels really big. And also like you need to just take the next small step into this world.
Yeah, I am so happy that you brought that up. I'm literally like taking notes as you're talking, because I think this is such an important conversation. And there's a couple of things. So we are so obsessed. Like I'll speak for myself and then the folks inside City School, like so obsessed with interdisciplinarity, because I really do believe that the folks that have encouraged us to flatten, whether it's jobs, whether it's academia, whether it's maybe even our own family and friends, right? That is a colonial inheritance. That is a colonial technology to say, you know, focus on this one thing. The issue is that you're too scattered. That's always the kind of reframe. And I really want to give us tools for figuring out how we resist that. So inside of the retreat, we do something called a creative ecosystem audit that helps you figure out, okay, what is your element X? This is something that N.K. Jemisin talks about, this brilliant science fiction writer. She talks about like the element X as something that frames an entire narrative of a speculative story, right? So in Black Panther, it's vibranium. With X-Men, it's mutation, right? This like thing, this oddity that starts to inform the whole entire story, this like keyword or key theme. And I'm always inviting people to figure out, okay, what's that keyword, that key theme that can start to bind your entire practice together? When we talk about a world, we're really just talking about your practice. And an offer is one node of your entire practice, right? So there are things where I'm like, no, like this, your morning pages, that walk in the forest, your dinner party series that you do with your friends, that's yours. Right. That is a part of your practice. That's yours. You like, we don't have to figure out how to monetize every single node in our world, every single node in our practice. But what is one node that we can offer up to fund the entire practice, to resource the entire world? But there is something that I'm always saying is like, even improvisational jazz needs a framework. Even right, a playground, we there has to be a ground to play on, right? I think there is something to be said about creative constraints, and that specificity is something that we talk a lot about in Cedar School. Like, how do we actually get super clear on all of the divergent nodes? How do we create some sort of messaging and storytelling around like the scale of it all, right? Because that's the thing that intimidates us, right? And that's the thing that makes us in a loop of inaction. For me, it definitely was. Like, there's too many skills to choose one or try to figure out how to flatten it, which is what I ended up doing. I'm like, oh my goodness, I have so many skills. The issue is, right, that I need to flatten it and choose one, when it turns out it's the exact opposite, right? How do I choose them all, but create a story through which I'm able to communicate all of that emergence clearly?
Are you feeling fed up, burned out, or totally sick of social media? Are you wondering if your business might be able to be successful without it, or if your creative work would still find its way out in the world without you posting it on Instagram or TikTok every 10 minutes? If you can relate to any of these musings of mine, I want to invite you to join me in The Interweb. The Interweb is an annual membership for creatives, artists, small business owners, freelancers, influencers, entrepreneurs, and creators who want support sharing their work and making money without social media. When you join, you get access to on-demand courses taught by biz friends across the internet and quarterly live events with me, Amelia. If you love this podcast, I hope that you'll head to the show notes to learn more and sign up so that I really can see you off the grid and on the interweb. Now, let's get back into today's episode. I think this has kind of come up around the edges of this conversation, but I've noticed that on your website or in the materials about Seed to School, you don't use the word business. You talk about creative offer, you talk about income generating. And so as a person who's like very steeped in a sort of like small business owner framework, I'm really curious, like, how do you relate to business as a concept or a practice?
So the word business comes up in the Seed to School syllabus, and I don't do that on purpose, I guess. Like you pointed this out, it's like, oh, okay, that's something that I'm doing. But I think it's disingenuous to say what we're doing is not entrepreneurship. Like, your creative offer is a small business. If it's generating income and right there's an exchange of goods and services, it gets a business, and that it's okay to say that. And it's not a word that I like ever shy from on purpose. I think what I'm more so lean into is the idea of this being a practice. And the business is just one small part of the larger practice, right? Of the larger world, of right, the larger rehearsal of like living into and embodying the worlds that we're dreaming up. Again, those worlds need resources, right? Whether it's we're paying for studio space, whether it's we're paying for materials, right? Whether it's we're paying collaborators, right? We're paying each other, right? All of that needs some sort of resources, you know? So maybe you have this creative business that provides those resources, but we're actually resourcing is the whole entire practice. That's what I try to get folks to remember, or invite folks to remember, is that we don't have to give up the like wild, maybe even illegible and quote unquote, like non-marketable parts of our practice in order to sustain them. And we don't even have to think of them different as separate entities. And I do not in any ways think of my marketing practice or my newsletter or my podcast as separate than my creative practice, right? Because it's all those things that make the creative practice possible and keeps the lights on inside of the world, right? So thank you for that question. I think it's like a both and, right? It's like we're doing all the above.
Oh, I really appreciate your response. And something it's bringing up for me is, you know, as creators and artists and business owners, we're drawing from like the same well of our energy. Like, we're pulling from source, we're pulling from self, like that's doing all of it. And so in my head, I'm like, all these pipes coming out of my system. And like there's a way that I'm tempted to really make it very mechanical and think of it as like, well, there's a pump that goes there, one that goes there, one that goes there. But it's not. Like, I'm just this like sprinkler shooting out all of this energy, and it's landing in these fields of this creative ecosystem. And I can maybe point myself in a direction, but it's like, I very much feel the way that it's all part of the same ecosystem. When it rains, it's landing on all of it. And while there are specific vessels, like there are gardens, you know, there we plant different things in different places, they're not as separate as I, even myself, like speaking for myself, will often think of them. And I'm always struck by the way that each vessel needs all the others. Mm-hmm. When I exclusively pour myself into the business, I get very drained. It's like I've overwatered it, and everything just starts to kind of get muddy and messy, and I feel depleted. And it feels counterintuitive, but like, if I'm not making my tiny tarot podcast that I just make for myself, the business isn't doing as well because I'm not serving all of these different pieces. And it takes time to figure out like, oh, well, maybe I don't need this piece, or maybe this is done and I can put that, you know, garden bed to rest. But like, there has to be this sort of diversity in the ecosystem, things that are serving different aspects of my creative practice. And I think about this a lot, even within my business. When I launched it, you know, I would pull tarot cards and light candles and do all these things. And then during busy periods, all that would go away and I'm only working. And that's how I get burned out. I think that's how many of us get burned out. We neglect the other aspects of the practice. We think of it just as the work, and there's so much more to it which is what your work reminds me of all the time. Like, there's so much more than just that, like, work in exchange for money. Like, that's, it's not enough. Like, frankly, that's just not enough.
Exactly. And not only is it not enough, the playtime is what makes our ecosystem so juicy. It is what makes the business so powerful, right? Like, it is what keeps the ideas really fresh. First of all, just beautiful analogy with the sprinkler and the gardens. I'm like, that is so good. And you're absolutely right. Like, if I'm not frolicking in the forest for 2 hours a day, if I'm not writing poetry in the bath, like, I feel it in my facilitation. I feel it when I'm showing up on the podcast. And maybe the folks that we're serving feel it too. But, you know, this is why for me, like, the emphasis on practice is key. Right? Because it's like, there are times where I go weeks without really, really soaking in the bath when I know that's my thing. There are times when, you know, I skip days visiting the forest when I know that is what truly, truly charges me. But the practice is returning, right? The practice is forgetting and remembering. And each time, like, returning anew. Right? With new data and new, like, conversations that you're bringing to the practice, that, and then the practice then speaks to you in different ways, right? And different connections get made. So when I'm away from the forest for a while, new things have happened, you know? And I think that's part of it too. Just, you know, giving ourselves the grace that we are going to leave it every now and then. But the beauty is the consistency of the return, I think. Like, often new ideas emerge from that as well. But you're absolutely right. We have to make room for all of it. And when we can't, we know it's always there to pick back up again.
Yeah, this is reminding me of something you wrote that I read recently, I think, around discipline melting into devotion. Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. The places where, you know, we're perhaps taught or trained to have, like, you have to do it every day. But what I just heard and what you're saying is, like, yes, that can be helpful to, like, build the practice. But when you're really integrated in it, you're just devoted to it. And then you can return again and again, and, like, the space away or the time when you don't go to the forest, like, you feel it, you know that. And you don't go back out of a sense of, like, discipline and being punished if you don't. Like, you go back out of a sense of, like, I desire this, I want this, I need this, I have to go back, I have to return.
Yeah, I missed
and
you,
that
boo.
Devotion. Yes, to all the trees. And if I'm remembering the syllabus correctly, at CETA School, everything starts with desire, doesn't it?
Yes.
Can you talk a little bit about the beginnings? Like, how do you guide people into connecting with their desires?
Yeah. In the very first week, we use something called the Element X Quadrant. And it's, like, loosely inspired by, like, Gay Hendricks Quadrant. But there's, like, the zone of domination, like, the things that we absolutely should stay away from. And for me, I always joke, this is the stove and the state. Like, anything to do with cooking, anything to do with legal stuff, taxes, I am just going to pay the professionals. I'm going to ask for help. And then, like, there's the zone of competence where it's like, we can do these things. We're good at these things. They get done. But it's hard to find our creative voice because it's someone else's creative spirit really flourishes here. So for me, this is, like, graphic design. It's something I can do. Video editing, it's something I can do. But I know there are just, like, other magicians, other people whose heart really sings doing this work. And then there's, like, our zone of validation. This is where I was for years. And this is, like, this is the place where we are getting paid well for this work, right? We are getting praise for this work, whether it's from coworkers, colleagues, collaborators, family, friends. This work just feels too, like, externally validating to give up. And for me, this was software engineering. Folks love a Black woman in STEM. Like, they are obsessed, right? And I would, you know, I joke in this essay I wrote, we will not innovate our way out of white supremacy. I joke how, you know, I would get called a unicorn and do a twirl, right? Like, I would eat it up.
Yeah.
Right? Oof,
yeah.
But ultimately, I knew, and I could have stayed in that career for much longer, honestly, and probably been like, you know, I've had to take a couple of sabbaticals, but was able to get back on the horse again and again. And, you know, ultimately, I realized, like, software engineering, you kind of have to sit in front of the computer for 6-8 hours a day if you really want to establish a career there until you become something like a senior software engineer where you may spend less time in front of the computer. So I was like, okay, that's actually in my zone of validation. But then we get to the zone of desire. And I invite people to say, what is the thing you secretly dream of orienting your entire life around? What are the creative practices you have told yourself possibly for years that, like, that's actually going to stay the sideshow, or that's actually going to stay the hobby? Or what are the things we're not giving ourselves permission to even imagine what it looks like to create life's work or like deeply oriented in that zone? For me, this was writing. I had no concept for a writer, not in my family or my immediate friends, of writers who were making a living writing poetry or making a living steeped in Black feminist research that weren't academics, right? Or weren't working inside the university. So once I gave myself permission to actually start imagining from inside the zone of my desire, I started coming up with all sorts of experiments that I could try, right? I started coming up with all sorts of different possibilities I could test drive. And sometimes it's just that little switch, that little bit of permission that can make all the difference. And I think this is what speculative fiction and world building does for us. It loosens up the stories that we have been navigating with our entire lives and says, but what if we could literally make it up from scratch, what will we choose? And that I feel like it just loosens up the stories, gives us the courage to imagine beyond, right? What our current life might look like, or the current framework of what we believe to be possible. And from that, you know, you hear all types of stuff. Healing work, tarot reading, writing, right? All of these different things. I'm like, okay, that's our element X. That's where we start. That's now the thing. That's the North Star of this entire world. And every single thing in our ecosystem is like branching from our desire, from the core of our desire. So this means our weekly dispatches, our offer, all of that is bridging from this like deep, deep, deep place of pleasurable permission.
It's amazing how much can change when we simply, as if it's easy, give ourselves permission.
Just like sweep away the childhood trauma.
Just, you know, like a couple centuries or more of oppression, all of that, brush it off.
Yeah, no, this is lifetime practice.
Yeah, but it is so powerful. Like if we can get there, it's reminding me of something I said, I think, on the episode about escaping the attention economy, where I don't actually really like the framework of the attention economy because it treats my attention as scarce. I feel like this is related to frameworks that treat our creative energy as scarce. And what I've discovered is if I'm really acting in my zone of desire, to use your words, like my creative energy is not scarce. My attention is not scarce. It is abundant. It is infinite. And it may have constrictions from the fact that I live in the material world with its systems and structures, but like I have an endless well that I can draw from when I'm operating in that zone of desire. And I don't think that an economic framework for limited material resources is the one I want to use in relationship to my creativity or my attention. And everything that we've been talking about, new worlds, world building as a Black feminist practice, changing the frameworks, giving ourselves permission, just feels really deeply about unlocking that abundance for ourselves and for our communities.
Exactly. Right. When we're operating in our zone of validation, we are like our curiosity, there's a ceiling on it. Our capacity, there's a ceiling on it. Right. If I was honest, I'm not gonna lie. If I was a software engineer right now and I was in that pathway because it's misaligned with my zone of desire, I probably wouldn't be you know, maybe munching on software engineering books on the weekend or like listening to software engineering podcasts, right? And just kind of like immersing myself, right, in this world, even when I'm like, quote unquote, technically not getting paid for it. The beauty of operating in our zone of desire is that our curiosity is endless. It is, like you said, a well that keeps getting watered every single day. We're never out of ideas. Our curiosity is never running dry. Like the questions and the answers just be getting questions. And right, it's something that we can stay tuned into for the stretch of a lifetime and feel watered every time we do instead of depleted.
Feeling watered. I love that.
And from there, the possibilities are endless, right? From there, we can really then actually practice at the world building scale of our desire. So like you, as you mentioned, there's like this material reality. We have a body that we have to tend to, right? So we do have a limited capacity in that perspective. But when we're operating from the zone of our design, our imagination is truly infinite and endless, then the writing begets more writing, right? The paintings beget more paintings, and we're constantly returning to it, even in fear, right? Even when, as we get to different scales of the vision, whether it starts as a newsletter, then emerges into a book, then it emerges into like whatever your dream, a Netflix special, whatever the scale of your dream is, at each stage, it's like the curiosity and the desire becomes something that is powerful enough to rival the fear. Finally, that's the place that I, in the week one, I'm like, we're dreaming from this place, because there's going to be a whole bunch of fear and a whole bunch of nervous system stuff that we have to work through. But the only thing that can rival the fear is like the love and the desire that we have for like our creative practice and creative vision.
I feel so nourished and complete from everything we just talked about. This will be releasing the week before you open registration for the spring session of your retreat. So could you tell folks how they can step into this work with you and join you in the Zeta School retreat this season?
First of all, y'all may be listening to this and it's like, I don't know what my creative offering is, right? I don't even know if I have a creative practice. I mean, most folks, I think your listeners are a pretty creative bunch, but they may be like, well, I don't know if I have an offer per se. So I created something called the Creative Offer Questionnaire to Oneself. It's inspired by the Audre Lorde Questionnaire to Oneself. Folks can find it at cedaschool.com/questionnaire. And in it, there are a series of questions I ask to help you kind of locate what that creative offer might be. And then there's also some really, really beautiful Audre Lorde quotes on visibility and fear, right? And transforming language into action, right? Because I think that's also something we come up against is like discomfort and the dis-ease around being seen or perceived. And, you know, that has a lot to do with maybe the trauma of existing inside capitalism and being consumed. But I'm also wondering, like, how do we show up for the people that we dream of serving? How do we show up for the ancestors who got us here, right? And how do we show up for the people who aren't even born yet, right? How do we show up for the next generation? And some of that requires a little bit of visibility and showing up. So that is an offering that folks can engage with to start to figure out what that creative offer may be and what their value aligns commitments might be inside of it.
Beautiful. So we'll link the questionnaire in the show notes, of course, for everyone listening. Check that out. You can also head there to learn more about the retreat and to subscribe to Ayana's newsletter and podcast.
Yeah, by downloading the questionnaire, you'll be on our email list. And so I'll be sure to email folks as soon as enrollment opens for the spring retreat.
Ayana, is there anything else you'd like to share with Off the Grid listeners today?
This is something that I shared in the most recent newsletter, this one line that goes, you know, it doesn't happen overnight, but it does happen. There's this Tina Camp quote that says, right, we're realizing futures that haven't happened yet, but must. They're inevitable. So take your time,
go slow, but whatever it is you're dreaming of, it must happen. So thank you for facilitating this conversation. I feel so full too. And thank you for everything that you bring to your practice, Amelia. Your words definitely was what they were watering my imagination. You were being a sprinkler for me in the early days. So thank you.
Well, thank you for those kind words. I feel very filled up and watery. Listeners, I hope you feel the same. We're going to sign off this episode, but until next time, we will see you off the grid and on the interweb.
Thanks for listening to Off the Grid. Don't forget to grab your free Leaving Social Media Toolkit at offthegrid.fun/toolkit. This podcast is a Softer Sounds production. Our music is by Melissa Caitlin Carter of Making Audio Magic, and our logo is by Natelier Studio. I'm your host, Amelia Ruby, and until next time, I'll see you off the grid and on the interweb.
Let's go off the grid.
Okay.
Let's go off the grid.
Okay.
I know that you really want to put your phone